This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva with another installment in our Jews, Judaism, and Modernity series. We've been looking at topics related to the origins of modern anti-Semitism, and after a couple of discussions of Russia and of pogroms and things like that there, we're going to turn our attention back to the West and look at the rise of modern anti-Semitism in the West, specifically tonight in Germany, and depending on how much we cover next time in other parts of Europe. Next week is the thick of Hanukkah, and Web Yeshiva will be on break, so we won't be meeting next Tuesday night. We'll meet again in 2 weeks' time. We saw in Eastern Europe that around the year 1880, there is a change in the temperature, and although Jews were never embraced with a full-bodied bear hug and a hearty welcome and unbridled friendship by the host society, there was a change that swept over the Russian Empire in ways that we discussed. Back in Germany in the 1870s, there was a very powerful German Empire, what was known as the Second Reich. The Third Reich, the subsequent Reich, or reign or rule, of course, is more well known to us. And the Second Reich emerges in Europe largely through the efforts of this fellow. You have to love. I don't know what's better, the pith helmet or the mustache. I'm not sure if that's not a pith helmet. I don't know what that model of helmet is called, that German helmet with the spike on top. It's not a pith helmet. Is what Groucho Marx wore in those in the captain playing Captain Spaulding, you know, the African explorer helmet. This is some other kind of. I don't know if anybody knows the proper name for the German military helmet with a spike on it. Please let us know. A Pickelhaub. Thank you, Joel. I imagine that means a pick helmet, and that it has nothing to do with pickles. Anyway, I don't know what I like more about this picture of good old Otto von Bismarck, the mustache, or the Pickelhaub. Okay, you can look at the etymology of the term Pickelhaub in the chat. Plural Pickelhauben from the old German Pickel, point, or pickaxe, and Haub, meaning bonnet, a general word for headgear. Okay. So Bismarck, who's also known as the Iron Chancellor of Prussia, was, of course, a central figure in uniting the German principalities into a strong German empire. As late as the 19th century, remember, Europe was largely agricultural, with a lot of peasants and poverty. And these elements had a very strong superstition and traditions, religious traditions, particularly as it comes to how the Jews are thought of and identified. Jews, of course, were viewed as Christ killers, as well poisoners, as the devil incarnate. They're also viewed, of course, as vicious moneylenders, the stereotype of Shylock, as depicted by Shakespeare, is of course something of an over-the-top stereotype, but it was playing on It was playing on stereotypes and notions and prejudices that were very widespread and which really existed in Europe through the 19th century and had not disappeared. These stereotypes lead to the ideas of ritual murder, of blood libels, what we saw, what we discussed last time, the idea that the Jews are the idea that the Jews murder Christian children and use their blood for ritual purposes, for baking matzot or things of that nature. But in the modern times that we're talking about, the end of the 19th century, the rise of nationalism in Europe gives a kind of new shape to the status of the Jews in the Christian eyes. And the Christians ask questions like, who are the Jews? They seem, I'm speaking, of course, in the third person about ourselves, but understand that I'm taking on the voice of the Christian narrator of our story. The Jews seem to have all of the attributes of a nation. This is a time when Europe is beginning to ask questions of the nationalism questions. What makes a nation? What unites a people into nationhood? And you look at the Jews and you see on one hand, the Jews seem to have all of the characteristics of being a nation. They have their own language, they have their own customs, they have their own laws, but they don't have a territory of their own. They promise loyalty to whatever land they're living in, but they nevertheless maintain these very suspicious international ties. All of the Jews are united with the Jews of other countries, and this causes a lot of suspicion. If France and Germany are at war, well, what does that say about the Jews in France and the Jews in Germany? If Germany and Russia are at war, well, what about all the Jews that live on our side of the border and all the Jews that live on their side of the border? And the fact that they have this own language that they speak, this Yiddish that is like a common secret coded language that they can communicate with each other across enemy lines, as it were. And this, of course, makes the Jewish people very suspect in the eyes of the eyes of their Christian hosts. The Jews have this very strong ethnic cohesion, in all different types of ways, including philanthropic ways, that they're going to help each other out. They're going to send money at a certain point when a settlement in Palestine starts to grow. They're sending money abroad to support their Jewish friends and relatives, and fellow co-religionists, and they're sending our German money abroad, our francs, our French francs abroad to support other Jews instead of spending it here and supporting our own economy. These reasons account for a certain amount of anti-Jewish resentment, but they can't justify a full-blown anti-Semitism. They had to be ignited for pragmatic ends. These were the firecrackers that could start the bonfire. But in and of themselves, they're not enough to lead to ultimately to a Holocaust. However, with experts in mob psychology at the end of the 19th century, these small flames can be fanned into something much bigger. The German conservative nationalists began to identify Jews with as being synonymous with all of the dangerous ideas that they wanted to demonize. Ideas like liberalism, ideas like internationalism for the reasons that I described earlier. Again, in an era during the rise of nationalism, you're thinking of, I'm not making commentary now on contemporary political discourse in the United States about immigrants and border control, but in an era of particular xenophobia and an idea where we need strong borders, the idea that you have these people in your midst who have these connections abroad is very, very, very suspicious. The German nationalists called attention to Jewish interests in capitalism. In Russia, Jews were attracted to socialism. In Germany, of course, Jews were attracted to capitalism. Those two great figures, Marx and Engels, of course, were Jews, and the title of their book was Das Kapital. And these ideas are enough to stir up in the lower class and the middle class a real anti-Jewishness. In the old days, you'd stir up anti-Semitism through a blood libel. You'd appeal to those superstitious or those unwarranted fears that Jews drank Christian blood. In the modern era, you don't do that. The German society doesn't do that. They don't appeal to blood libels. They appeal through economics. And that's one of the marks of modern anti-Semitism. In some ways, it seems so much more rational, but in reality, it's not. Again, if you have a webcam, please hit the send video button from the video panel. Almost nobody has their videos on tonight. Maybe you're all embarrassed of how much weight you've gained over Thanksgiving. I don't know. I was in London for Thanksgiving, and they did not celebrate it. There was nary a turkey or a cranberry to be seen, and it was just really cold. Is there anybody online? Don't we have somebody from London with us? Isn't there somebody with us from London, or is that in the other shire? Let me look. No, I don't think so. Okay. So, again, if you have a webcam, hit send video. If you don't have a webcam, get a webcam. Okay. Hold on a second. I'm just looking through some of these chats. Fine. The 1870s were particularly difficult years financially for the lower middle class, and of course for the lower class, things are always very bad. And it's during this time that a figure named Adolf Stoker comes to rise. Here he is. These guys always look so stiff. Stoker, 1835 to 1909, was a very clever demagogue, and this is something that we see in a lot of different cases. We saw it in Russia. We talked about the Rasputin syndrome, the idea that behind the throne there's always this Svengali pulling the strings. He had a deep fear for the middle class, and he tried to bring it into line with the conservative movement and the conservative frame of mind. In 1878, he found something called the Christian Social Workers Party, the CSWP, the Christian Social Workers Party, which is a kind of socialism that called for a lot of different type of worker welfare ideas, trying to help the lower middle class, the working class, what we call today the working class. But yet it wasn't as radical as Marxism or more radical forms of socialism. He was elected to the Reichstag, the German the German parliament, as it were, in the 1880s. And to make his program as appealing as possible, he used anti-Semitism as a political rallying tool to stoke the masses, to stir up the base. And it was very appealing to the lower middle class. This is, we see this in every era, whether it's anti-Semitism or scapegoating some other group, often a minority group, in order to rally the masses to your cause and to play on their on their fears. He's the first person to make anti-Semitism a kind of national issue in Germany. Again, social anti-Semitism there always was in Germany and Europe, but the idea that it becomes a kind of national rallying cry, he's the first one to do it. He rekindles a kind of, again, a kind of social anti-Semitism in the 1870s and the 1880s. Restrictive signs in restaurants, in hotels, anti-Semitic slogans, things like that. I mean, think of the racism of the United States in the 60s, where technically speaking, technically speaking, the Jews are citizens of Germany, just like African Americans were full citizens of the state of Alabama or Mississippi. But yet, if you tried to sit down at a lunch counter, we know what happened. If you didn't go to the back of the bus, we know what happened. The same type of thing. But yet, Stoker's is not a racial anti-Semitism. And here I want to pause for a second to make a distinction between social anti-Semitism versus racial anti-Semitism. By the end of our discussion tonight, we'll have seen the introduction of racial anti-Semitism. But social anti-Semitism plays on fears of the Jew as the other, as unlike us, as un-German. He doesn't share our culture, he doesn't share our ways or our beliefs. He's a pariah, he's a bloodsucker, the Jew is trying to bleed us, if not bleed us our blood to bake his matzahs, then to bleed all of our money through money lending and things of thing and capitalism and things of that nature. That's the kind of anti-Semitism of Stoker. He saturated the lower classes with a rabid Jew hatred, and that laid the groundwork for the racial anti-Semitism which would follow. So Stoker is very important, one, in that he introduces anti-Semitism as a political tool, and two, that he was able to spread ideas, awful as they were, of a demonization of the Jew, which would r ready the ground for an even more dangerous idea, a racial anti-Semitism, which I'll come back to in a second. Bismarck himself, if you don't know who Bismarck is, if your 10th grade world history study from way back when is a little foggy, so it's worth looking him up on Wikipedia. Bismarck himself, he was the leader of the Conservative Party. He wasn't anti-Semitic per se. On the contrary, he had a lot of personal associations with Jewish bankers, who apparently he held in privately, he held in high esteem. But by the 1880s, by the early 1880s, he realizes that the only way to woo the lower middle class support is through anti-Semitism. And with that, he provides German anti-Semitism with the ingredient that it needed, a certain type of respectability. Everyone understood that Adolf Stoecker was something of a dangerous ideologue and a rabble-rouser. Bismarck was not viewed that way. And if he takes on an idea, that lends it a certain respectability. I mean, Havdil, again, I'm not. It's always so tempting to point to contemporary political trends. Everybody understands that there's a certain type of rhetoric you're going to get by watching Fox News. And if a political commentator on Fox News, or even a political figure, maybe someone associated with the Tea Party, who might be channeling the same ideas that you'll see on Fox News, that's a certain point of view. It represents a not insignificant, on the contrary, an increasingly large percentage of the American citizenry. But that's not the same as if the new Speaker of the House, who purports to be above all that, would say the same kinds of things. Let's say, again, to take contemporary examples, about immigration policy or about immigrants themselves. And that distinction is important to bear in mind here. In the early 1890s, Stoecker is thrown out of power, and the Christian socialism movement that he started begins to fall into oblivion. But not the organized anti-Semitism that he—that was his great legacy. You understand these terms that I'm using to when I say his great legacy. There's nothing great or good or bad. These aren't value judgments, but his legacy is the institutional anti-Semitism that he created as a fixture of German political life. Jew hatred was now respectable, and it was destined to endure as a strong political tool of the German right. Let's just take a look quickly. We don't have time to read the whole thing. This is a piece that Stoecker himself wrote. I think I included the footnote here. Yeah, this is the text of a speech that Stoecker delivered at the Christian Social Workers Party rally in September 1879. In September 1879. And again, here's just his short biography. Stoecker was a German anti-Semitic preacher and politician. He was an imperial court chaplain from 1874. He was a member of the Prussian Diet from 1879 to 1898. The Diet is not a place where you go to eat cottage cheese and exercise. It's the house of the Prussian House of Parliament, as it were. In 1881, he was elected to the Reichstag, where he served with certain periods of time where he was out of office until 1908, when he dies right before he dies in 1878, he founded the Christian Social Workers Party. Through the party, Stoecker created a right-wing mass movement of disenchanted artisans and small shop owners, who were later joined by members of the conservative educated classes. He was a powerful demagogue who knew how to channel discontent into anti-Semitism. His inflammatory speeches paved way for paved the way for the rampant anti-Semitic movement in Berlin in the 1880s, which spread to provincial cities and the countryside. So this is a text of a speech that he gives, called "What We Demand of Modern Jewry." You can read the whole thing on your own. but he says, I do not consider modern Jewry a great danger to German national life. By this, I mean neither the religion of the Orthodox nor the enlightenment of the Reformed. So he says, Jewry itself isn't a danger to modern, or isn't a danger to German life. And by Judaism, I don't mean neither Orthodoxy nor Reform Judaism. Orthodox Judaism, ossification of the law, the Old Testament without a temple, without priests, without sacrifice, without a Messiah, is neither attractive nor dangerous. So he says, first of all, Orthodox Judaism isn't a threat to Germany because it's a dinosaur. It's a form of religion which is dead at its very core. Now, of course, Stoiker is joining a long list of people that were quick to announce the death of Orthodox Judaism. Reports of our demise. What was it that Mark Twain said? Reports of my demise have been exaggerated. Reports of my death have been exaggerated. So he's one of a long line that's happy to make a prediction. But of course, this was 1879, 1979. This was over 130 years ago, and Orthodox Judaism is still around. Reform Judaism, on the other hand, is of even less religious significance. Now, this is really important because we saw that very much part of the Reform movement was a notion that if we changed certain things, certain external things, but also obviously certain ideological, theological components of Judaism, that Judaism would be palatable to the non-Jewish world. This is in Berlin, for goodness sakes. We're not talking about Poland. We're talking about Berlin, the home base of Reform Judaism. And he says Reform Judaism is even less significant. It's neither Judaism nor Christianity, but a pitiful remnant of the Age of Enlightenment. Its ideas did not originate on Jewish soil, but in a wretched period of the Christian Church, a period long since overcome by the Church itself. Both factions boast, of course, that the Jews are the bearers of the loftiest religious and moral ideas for mankind in the world, and that it is the mission of Jewry, now and in the future, to maintain those ideals, to develop and spread them. On this point, the Jewish press, from right to left, stands united. Here we wish to make our request. So he's speaking to his followers, and he says, this is what we request, this is what we demand of the Jews. We ask, please, be a little more modest. I mean, the whole tone is dripping with sarcasm. We do not deny that Israel carried the knowledge. I mean, here he makes a point which is an old straw of anti-Semitism, that Judaism once was the bearer of revelation and truth, but that Old Testament was abrogated and replaced by a New Testament, by Christianity, and Judaism is now, those that still subscribe to Judaism are the bearers of a broken tradition. And he goes on at some length. This is a theological point that he's making. And then he makes an idea that trying to point out that Judaism itself, classical Judaism itself, was full of all types of backwards notions which were only set right not merely through Christianity, but through German Christianity and German law. German law alone protect the concept of common property, etc., etc. You can read this on your own. The question is, what shall be done? he says. We believe that Jews and Christians must try to establish a proper relationship with each other. There is no other way. You see, he's not yet suggesting the solution is to kill all the Jews. He's not even suggesting the solution is to kick them all out. But we need to develop a quote-unquote proper relation. Hatred of the Jews is already flaring up here and there, and this is repugnant to the Gospels. If modern Jewry continues to use the power of capital and the power of the meaning of money and the press to bring misfortune to the nation, a final catastrophe is unavoidable. The press, there were many Jewish press barons. There were newspapers, not just Jewish newspapers, but there were newspapers that were owned by Jews, and this was viewed with great suspicion. The same way as in the United States, the fact that the New York Times was owned by Jews, by the Ox and Sulzberger families, also, by the way, Yekisha Jews, German Jews. This was viewed with derision or suspicion. So Israel must renounce its ambition to become the master of Germany. It should renounce its arrogant claim that Judaism is the religion of the future, when it is so clearly that of the past. Let not foolish Christians continue to strengthen the self-conceit of this people. Jewish Orthodoxy, with its circumcision, is decrepit, while Reform Judaism is not a Jewish religion at all. So, and it's, he has it both ways. He says, look, Orthodox Jews are just backward Neanderthals. They're dinosaurs. Reform Jews are even worse, because they're basically Christians, but they don't have the decency to admit it. Again, I'm channeling his thoughts, not my own. Once Israel has realized this, it will quietly forget its alleged mission and stop trying to rob of their Christianity people who offer it hospitality and civil right. The Jewish press must become more tolerant. That is the first prerequisite for improving the situation. It's a critique of the media. Again, I'm trying not to do it, but there's so many parallels with contemporary American political culture. The critique of the media, not of Jewish control of the media per se, but the social abuses which are caused by Jewry must be eradicated by wise legislation. It will not curb Jewish capital. It will not be easy to curb Jewish capital. Only thoroughgoing legislation can bring it about. And now he makes a radical suggestion. The mortgage system in real estate should be abolished and property should be inalienable and unmortgageable. Again, the banks are owned by Jews. They foreclose on homes that people have mortgaged and can't afford to pay for the mortgages. Again, it's just, there are just so many parallels with contemporary scenarios. The credit system should be, Jews were bankers. There were homes that were mortgaged to Jewish banks. So basically, Jews owned so much property because of through the banking system. The problems of capitalism, of Jews holding capital. Stock exchange regulations, reintroducting the denominational census so as to find the disproportionate between Jewish capital and Christian labor. So he says we need to, in the census, when they would take census in Germany, at a certain point they were no longer counting. They were counting in such a way that it wasn't as apparent who's Jewish and who's Christian. And he says we need to know. We need to know who the Jews are in the country, where in the country they are, because there's this disproportion between Jewish capital and Christian labor. Limitation of appointments of Jewish judges in proportion to the size of the population. So this is, I mean, look at the Supreme Court of the United States. It's unbelievable. There are 9 justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. 3 of them are Jews. 6 of them are Catholics. Of those Catholics, 1 is a Hispanic and 1 is an African American. There's not a single WASP, There's not a single Anglo-Saxon Protestant on the Supreme Court of the United States. It's remarkable. So you understand why some people might think that the Jews are in control of what's going on. A third of the members of the Supreme Court are Jewish. How many Jews are there in the United States? Less than 3%. How many senators are there in the United States? 100. So how many Jews should there be if it was proportional? 2, 3. In reality, how many Jewish senators are there? Quite a lot more. I mentioned I was in London this week. In London, Her Majesty the Queen Elizabeth II, when she wasn't at the Vort for the engagement of her grandson, to which I was not invited, they announced the honors list. They announced the new lords, the people that are being appointed to the House of Lords, the upper chamber of Parliament, which is an appointment. It's not an election, but these are what are called they're lifetime appointments, but they're not hereditary appointments. It's not like your children become lords after you. Tony Blair did away with most of those. But it's a lifetime appointment to the House of Lords. There were 15 people appointed to the House of Lords. 5 of them were Jews. 2 of those 5 are frum. Two of the five lords are Orthodox Jews, or at least associate with the Orthodox community minimally. In England, the Jews make up about 0.5% of the total population. You can understand why there's this sense. I don't need to finish the sentence. And this is what Stoiker is saying. Removal of Jewish teachers from the grammar schools, in addition to the strength of Christian Germanic spirit, etc., etc., etc. Either we succeed in this and Germany will rise again, or the cancer from which we suffer will spread further. In that event, our whole future is threatened, and the German spirit will become Judaized. So again, he's not saying the Jews are vermin. He's not saying the Jews are vampires. He's saying the Jews represent an un-German element that has to be neutralized. We're not going to kick them out. We're not going to kill them. But we're going to, not Bram Stoker, right, but Adolf Stoker. Adolf's a name got bad press. And if you go into shuls, I remember when I was a kid, in the shul that I went to, where the average age of the people in the shul was about 100, and they had, you know, the Yahrzeit plaques. It's something we don't have here in Israel, really. But, you know, in shuls in America, they had these Yahrzeit plaques, you know, like these metal plaques with the names of the people and the death and life and death, you know, birth dates, and they had light bulbs. And when it was the week of the Yahrzeit, they'd turn on the light bulbs. And on Yom Kippur, for Yizkor, they'd turn on all the light. They were like those yellow, those orangey light bulbs that looked like flames. You know what I'm talking about, yes? So I remember you'd look at these old lists, these old names on the walls. They were in the shul that I went to. There were 200, 300 of these plaques. There were a lot of Adolfs, you know, people that were born in the 19th century. Adolf was once a very common Jewish name, and of course it fell out of use, not just by Jews but by everyone. So the name got a lot of bad press, I guess, and people don't name their kids Adolf anymore. At the end of the 19th century, in Germany, a number of conservative nationalists began to introduce a new idea. And that's the idea of racism. It was very appealing for at least two reasons. One is it provided Germany with a quote-unquote scientific rationale, namely that the idea of German racial superiority over all the other nations. And two, because anti-Semitism had become such a powerful tool, it was a justification to maintain and strengthen this status quo. German racism, of course, I trust that you know this all, and it's just a quick review, grows out of the Aryan myth, which was created by shoddy scholars and pseudoscientists using false anthropological theories and data showing that the German Aryans were the most superior of people in comparison to other races, particularly the Jews, who are at the bottom of the scale. Many German intellectuals, a surprising number of German intellectuals, join in and give weight and credence to these ideas. Richard Wagner. Wagner was, of course, the famous composer. He was like Elvis. I mean, we don't think of classical musicians as being rock stars, but they were. So Wagner was, of course, a famous anti-Semite, and he lent his name and reputation to these ideas. And again, it was like the Beatles. It was like Elvis. It was like, I don't even know what the contemporary equivalent would be. Because of that, of course, it's always been somewhat taboo to like Wagner if you're a Jew, or in Israel for many, 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 many years, his music wasn't played in the Philharmonic or in the symphonies. But that's a different discussion. And he claimed that Germans were in danger of a racial degeneration, a kind of contamination by mixing with the Jews. Wilhelm Marr, who we discussed, I think, 2 weeks ago, who's the one that coined the phrase anti-Semitism, as opposed to merely Jew hatred, which was the phrase before him, he published a book or a pamphlet called Victory of Judaism over Germanism in 1879, which also painted these notions of the Jews literally conquering the Germans by watering down the German stock. University professors provided anthropological or quasi-anthropological or quasi-historical evidence, quote-unquote, that German blood was in danger of contamination by contact with the Jews. In general, in the past, anti-Semitism always left open the hope or the temptation of conversion, that Jews could convert and could redeem themselves. Think of the Inquisition. Think of medieval anti-Semitism. It was because Jews were criticized for an intellectual problem or a theological flaw, that they did not accept Christ as the Messiah. But if a Jew were to do that, he would at least in principle be welcomed with open arms. Although in reality, sometimes there was prejudice even against converts. But in principle, the idea being that if a Jew were to recognize the error of his ways, so he could repair himself. And once he recognized the error of his ways and joined the Christians on their side of the border, on their side of the ideological border, theological border, so he could be, pardon the misuse of a term, they could be born again as a Christian and be accepted. That's no longer the case in the modern era in racial anti-Semitism. Because the problem isn't the Jews' beliefs or the Jews' theology. The problem is the Jew himself. And conversion is just a way to try to be Metaher the Sheretz, if you understand the reference. You can't, I mean, again, since we're using all of the contemporary political political comparisons. It's just lipstick on a pig. If a Jew converts, he's still a Jew. But Jew converts, he's still this genetically dangerous, polluting element. On the contrary, he's a wolf in sheep's clothing if he converts. That's why ultimately, 30 years later, with the rise of Nazism, it didn't matter if you were Christian. It didn't matter if your parents were Christian. If you had one Jewish grandparent, that was enough to contaminate you. Right? You could be the priest, son of a priest, if one of your grandparents was Jewish, you were going to Auschwitz because you were a cockroach. The racial anti-Semitism succeeded in dehumanizing the Jew to such a degree that if, like, you see a cockroach in your kitchen, what do? You step on it, you squash it, you get it out of the house. If you see a snake, you chop off its head. And that is the turn here. Racial anti-Semitism reduces the Jew to the level of the vampire bat. And once that idea grabs hold, there's only one possible end to the story. Racial anti-Semitism was controlled around these political splinter groups in Germany, which will then, of course, set the stage for the rise of Nazism 30 years down the road. And that change is what's so significant. Anti-Semitism or Jew hatred was part of the fabric of history from the beginning. This change, this introduction of this element, is what radicalized everything and opened the door to the final solution, or, as I've mentioned a few times, what really was the penultimate solution, the final solution, of course, being Zionism. I just want to, I always try to bring to your attention books of note on the topic of the history of anti-Semitism. This book, Jacob Katz's From Prejudice to Destruction, Anti-Semitism, 1700 to 1933, by Jacob Katz, K-A-T-Z, published by Harvard University Press. I saw on Amazon that it's selling for a lot of money, even though it's a paperback book. It's 390 pages or so. It was selling for like $40 on Amazon, but it was selling used on Amazon for, I think, $15. You could get it from around $15 on Amazon. It's worth having. If you have one book on anti-Semitism, I would say this would be the one. Thank you for the link. Alan. Jacob Katz, of course, himself was one of the great Jewish historians. He passed away, I don't know, I'm guessing about 10 years ago, plus minus. He was a very nice man. I had an occasion once to meet him in the library in Yerushalayim, in the National Library in Yerushalayim. At that point, he was literally a little old man, and it was the summer before I was going to start teaching Jewish history in high school in America, and I was in Yerushalayim for the summer, preparing some classes and doing some other things. Oh, I see. I'm quickly Googling. I see that there's a biography of Jacob Katz on Wikipedia, of course, and there's also a website dedicated to him. I think also some of his articles are there at Jacob Katz, jacobkatz.co.il. He died in 1998, so about 12 years ago. And he wrote actually on almost everything that we've been talking in our series, he wrote a book or the book in the field. Jewish-Gentile relations. Oh, there, look, if you go to that website, jacobkatz.co.il, there's a picture of him, and you see what I mean by a nice little old man. And he was really one of the pioneers in Jewish history here in Israel and elsewhere, of social history, the history of halacha. He wrote a book about in Hebrew it's called in English I think it's called Shabbos Goy, and in Hebrew it's called Hagoy Shel Shabbat, about the history of the halacha of utilizing non-Jews to perform malacha on Shabbat, which is, I'm sure as you know, a not uncomplicated set of halachot. There, Alan posted to the English translation of the book, which in English is called the Shabbos Goy. So Katz once commented that he was very nervous because, you know, very often, there's a tradition amongst Jews that when somebody publishes a book, they get called after the name of the book. So, like, for example, the Chafetz Chaim, whose name was Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan, author of the Mishnah Berurah, he became known as the Chafetz Chaim because that was the name of his book. Rav Yosef Karo becomes known as the Shulchan Aruch. So Katz said he was afraid he was going to be known as the Shabbos Goy because of this book that he wrote, the Shagas Aryeh, etc. Right, many examples. So Yaakov Katz was a very significant figure in developing the field of Jewish history, and this particular book about the history of anti-Semitism, it's a sweeping book. I mean, it covers 233 years of anti-Semitism, particularly about this turn from social anti-Semitism to racial anti-Semitism is well documented in that book. He also has another book called Out of the Ghetto, which also touches on many of the things that we've discussed about Jewish emancipation and things of that nature. So if you look on that website that lists the bibliography of all of his writings and of his books, I wonder if there might even be links, of course, to some of his books here. I'm not sure, but it's worth taking a look and familiarizing yourself with some of the folks whose scholarship has informed what we've been studying, and you might want to take it for your own further reading. So next week we don't meet because of Chanukah. Chanukah Sameach to all of you. If you are in Israel, please join us on Thursday night in Yerushalayim for the Web Yeshiva gathering. If you're not with us, so join us online at least for the Shi'ur. You can't join us for the Latkes or for the Blintzes or for the Sufganiyot or the other things that we're going to be serving. That you have to provide on your own. But you can join us for the Shi'ur at 8 p.m. Yerushalayim time. Rabbi Bravender will be giving a shiur about Hanukkah live to those of us gathered in Yerushalayim, and online to those of you who are unfortunately not with us, and you'll provide your own greasy food to go along with that. And we will continue in 2 weeks. Hanukkah Sameach. G-A-U-G. G-A-U-G-E.